You're listening to TFM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading in case I got bored.
Well, hello and welcome back to a very special New Year's episode of Literary Treks, New Year's 2026, if we're putting a clock on it. I am just one of the hosts, Casey Pettit, and with me, as he always is Jonathan Cohn. Jonathan, how are you this brand new year?
I am doing great, reinvigorated, have lots of goals for the year. We'll see if I reach them all. But one of the goals that you and I have had for a long time since we started hosting, we get to achieve that goal in this episode.
Yes. And that, of course, is we have nabbed the current developmental editor of Star Trek novels with Gallery Books, Scott Pearson, back in 2014. In January of 2014, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, 12 years ago.
Yeah. So, you know, it's the third full year of Literary Treks. Chris and Matt interviewed Margaret Clark, who, as we all are aware probably at this point, Margaret passed away at the early 2025, and Scott actually took over that role. And so we reached out to him, and he graciously accepted our offer to chat with us today. So we're very excited to share that. But first, we got a couple housekeeping items. The first is how to contact us.
If you'd like to contact us, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show. And there are many ways for you to do that. The best place is to join in the larger conversation in the Babel Conference, which is our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type in Babel, B-A-B-E-L, in the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Literary Treks. That will find its way to us. You can also find the network on X and Instagram at trekfm and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. We also have a dedicated Goodreads group for Literary Treks. Join us there, and you can see the books we've read and what's coming up next. If you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you, you can become a member of our Patreon in the Patreon network. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. You can even become an associate producer of your favorite show, just like Casey Pettit and Greg Rosier are for Literary Treks. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And lastly, please leave us a star rating and a written review wherever you get your podcasts. It's great for us, and it also helps others find the show.
We've got a special piece of news for us that was sent in by a listener, Jared Cooper. Thank you, Jared, for letting us know about a new Trek book that's not necessarily a novel. I think it's not a pocketbooks novel, but it's from Rob Perlman, who a lot of us know from other things that he's written. Like, I have behind me on a shelf the Search for Spock, Where's Waldo type book that Rob did. But, he's done a lot of fun books like that. But this one is Once Upon a Stardate, Star Trek Fairy Tales. And this is due out in, October 13th, 2026.
So the blurb says, transport yourself across the galaxy with this collection of illustrated Star Trek adventures adapted from classic fairy tales and narrated by Lieutenant Commander Data. Once Upon a Stardate collects beloved fairy tales from around our world, retold within the Star Trek universe. Familiar stories such as Pinocchio, The Emperor's New Clothes, and Hansel and Gretel take on new meaning as Data writes futuristic Starfleet-inspired versions of old Earth classics in an attempt to understand and convey to the next generation humanity's lasting connection to storytelling. Data reimagines stories from his adventures, as well as from Starfleet records, to create his own versions of The Three Little Pigs, Rip Van Winkle, Jack and the Beanstalk, and The Pied Piper, and many more, featuring characters such as La'an, Chapel, Ortegas, Scotty, Wesley Crusher, Q, and, Una McCormick's going to be happy with this one, Garrick even shows up. Each of these 18 tales features characters, locations, and events from all across 60 years of Star Trek. That's right, folks. We're at 60 years. Mm-hmm. And brought to life with original full-color illustrations. The tales are supplemented by 14 shorter fables that share wisdom from some of Starfleet's best-known captains, Kirk, Picard, Sisko, Janeway, Archer, Pike, and Burnham.
This looks amazing.
It looks delightful.
Yes. This will be a fun one to get later in the year and read through. It's something probably a little lighter. And you know, and for any folks out there with children, unlike the two of us, you know, this may be good bedtime stories for kids. I don't know. So we will look forward to seeing that one, and hopefully we'll get our hands on copies of that and maybe do an episode on that, something fun for the end of 2026. But that's a long way away. We've got some other things to talk about ahead of time, including, you know, what new Star Trek books are coming out. So maybe let's go invite Scott in and probe his mind. Well, we are very lucky to be joined today by Scott Pearson, who is, and I guess, Scott, you'll have to tell us, you know, exactly what you do, but one of the editors for Simon & Schuster that works on the Star Trek books. But welcome, Scott. Thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Just to start off, I guess for listeners who may not know your background, can you describe like what you do day to day as an editor at Simon & Schuster and kind of what your history, I guess, is with the Star Trek line in particular?
Sure. Well, I've been a Star Trek fan for my whole life, basically, about 50 years now. And so I've been reading the novels since the 70s. Then I was lucky enough to, when Simon & Schuster were running the Strange New Worlds short story contest anthologies back in the day, I got two stories published in there. So that was my transition from just being the fan to starting a professional relationship with the franchise. And so after a couple of Strange New Worlds short stories, I then was invited by Marco Palmieri to pitch for the Star Trek Next Generation 20th Anniversary Anthology. I had a story in there. So then he invited me to pitch for the third Myriad Universes volume. I got a short novel in there. And then Margaret Clark invited me to pitch for an ebook exclusive. And so I had an ebook exclusive, The More Things Change, published, as I said, exclusively an ebook. And that was then about the time that I had been, about the time that came out, was about the same time that I had been laid off from my in-house editing job where I edited nonfiction, a lot of military history. But then I was lucky enough, as I was out on the street, to be asked if I'd be interested in being the freelance copy editor of the Star Trek novel line, because they were looking for a new copy editor that had familiarity with the franchise. And so, I mean, they already knew there because of my writing, knew that I was a lifelong rabid Star Trek fan and I had read all the novels. And so then I was the copy editor for 10 years. And then recently I became the developmental editor.
And that was the position that Margaret had before she passed away. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes. And so after her sudden tragic passing, they got in touch with me and said, would you be able to step in for the 25-26 schedule that was already in progress that Margaret had had going before she became ill? And so of course, when Star Trek calls, I answer. And so now I've been working in that capacity for the last several months.
So did you always want to be working in editing nonfiction and fiction, or was that something that you just happened across?
It's funny. I've always known, well, not always, but since about the seventh grade, I knew that I wanted to be a writer. And for many, many years, I was convinced that editing would take too much time and energy away from my own writing. And so for many years, during college, post-college, I sort of vowed that I never wanted to be an editor. And then a buddy of mine from college started up his own small press and asked if I would help him with some proofreading and editing. So I was just helping him out as a friend. And then I started discovering that I really liked editing, and that it's sort of, it's a very sort of different process than writing. And so it doesn't really take away your energy. And then over the years, I've kind of discovered that it's kind of a nice circular thing. I think being a writer helps me be a better editor. Being an editor helps me being a better writer. But I still didn't really think of pursuing it professionally. I was just helping my friend whenever he had a book, and which was only once or twice a year. But then at a certain point, after my wife and I had our child, and I had been the stay-at-home parent for a few years, and once our daughter Ella started school, well, it's time to for me to get a job and start making some money. And my wife happened to notice an advert in the paper for a copy editing job at a local publishing company in St. Paul. And so I had this resume that I developed just editing for my friend. So I ended up getting that job and was there for 10 years, got a lot of experience editing. And so then everything just kind of came together. I got laid off there, like happens in publishing a lot. Editors get laid off. And and then Simon & Schuster was looking for a copy editor and started asking around who knows someone that could do this. And they happened to get in touch with Marco Palmieri, who was no longer at Simon & Schuster because he had been laid off like a year or so earlier. Right. And he said, well, you should get in touch with Scott Pearson. He's a, you know, he's a professional editor. He's doing some freelance editing. He's a Star Trek fan. He's written for us. And so I got the job.
That's awesome. When you wear two hats, you're an author and you're an editor. And you said that those kind of work well together because, you know, they take different kinds of energy, I guess. But when you're writing, and I'm not sure if you get much time to write these days, you know, with this job, but do you find it difficult to step out of the editor role and just kind of go back into author mode just to, you know, get your ideas onto the page? Or, you know, do you find that actually kind of helps you to leave your editor brain on to get through things a little easier?
No, I most of the time I can just start writing. You know, some writers are able to do what, you know, they call the vomit draft, where they just write and they crank through a story till they get to the end. I've never done that. Not always. Once word processors came around, I definitely became a edit as I go. So I'm always revising as I work on a story, which is kind of, it's a slower process. But then when I actually get to the last page of the story, it's usually in pretty solid shape. I don't have to go back and do a ton of editing to get it polished up. But what I find a little bit more challenging sometimes is then when I sit down to edit, especially on the Star Trek novels, you know, for 10 years I was the copy editor, and the developmental editor is a little bit more in a hands-on position with the author. And there are times when I realize, oh, I've just been looking at a few pages more as a copy editor. I need to take a close look as the developmental editor. But usually, well, you know, it's kind of a cliche, but writing is, you know, the creative process and editing is more analytical. And so depending on the manuscript and what you're doing, if you're writing or editing, it is kind of a, you know, right brain, left brain kind of thing where you can switch hats. But it's also my lifelong fanness for Star Trek both helps my copy editing or developmental editing of Star Trek fiction, because I can remember a lot of stuff. You know, you're trying to get all those details right. But it can also be a problem, because sometimes I'll realize I just read the last 10 pages like I was just a fan. I was just enjoying the story. Mm-hmm. Now I have to go back and make sure I'm actually doing the editing. You can get caught up in the story as much as, you know, just the regular reader.
So as a developmental editor, that's different from copy editing. Can you tell us kind of what that kind of role is, not just on the, when you're reading the book, but how does that affect like choosing the books and figuring out what book comes next in the process?
Yeah, I haven't been able to do any real choosing yet, a little because the schedule had been put together by Margaret already before I came on. But yeah, the copy editor comes on late in the process, where the manuscript is essentially done and you're just trying to put that final polish on there before it goes to the proofreader. But the developmental editor works with the author from the beginning, which would IP like Star Trek in a lot of rounds of approvals, because Paramount has to put their rubber stamp of approval on it. And if it's a book that ties into the new series, like Strange New Worlds and stuff, well, then that also needs to get Secret Hideout. That production company needs to put their stamp of approval on it as well. And so it starts with a pitch, a shorter pitch that goes through the approval process. And then it goes to a longer outline that goes to the approval process, and then the author writes the manuscript, and then the manuscript has to go through approval. And as the developmental editor, you're there the entire time. So the author sends me the pitch, I read the pitch, and I might say, oh, what if, you know, what if you say this instead of that? I might, you know, I'll give my 2 cents on the pitch, and I'll give my 2 cents on the outline. And then I take an editing pass on the completed manuscript as well. And so it's a more involved and lengthy process. And then, as you alluded to, then there are times where you're coming up, you know, the developmental editor might come up with an idea on their own and go out and approach a writer and say, hey, would you be interested in writing, you know, such and such novel with this kind of setup? Or it could also be that you just get in touch with one of the authors and say, hey, what do you want to do next? Do you, you know, and they might have an idea. I've only been able to do that like from the beginning once, because most of the schedule was already set in stone when I came on. But I'm finding that I really love being deeper into the process. I mean, I love being the copy editor, but I'm really enjoying working more closely with the authors. And of course, because I was the copy editor for 10 years, I've also already known most of the authors for many, many years. I'm friends with them. And so sometimes I'm still like, I get paid for this. I'm just like sitting around working on Star Trek with my buddies. It's a dream job.
Yeah. And in a beautiful version of musical chairs, now we have Marco coming back, and now he's the copy editor. So that's it's great to have him back.
Yeah, that was crazy and fun, because when I came on as developmental editor, I got in touch with the people at the in-house Simon and Schuster editors and said, you know, hey, I've got some suggestions for potential copy editors. I had spoken to some people I know that love Star Trek, that work in the publishing in various ways, writers in various ways. And so I had a couple of names to pitch, and they said, you know, these are great, but we're going to check in with Marco first. And it's like, I didn't even think of Marco, because it's like he has gone on to do all sorts of amazing, cool stuff. So then when he decided to do it, I was like, oh, this is great. You know, we got the band back together. We're all working together again. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun, very rewarding.
Yeah. I mean, we've had back in the, I don't know, 90s and before and even a little after that, you know, we were having so many books come out, just getting pumped out. And now we don't get as many, but man, the quality of the books these days, and I think that's partly because there's more time between them and, you know, working specifically on one at a time, that they've just been so good recently.
They have,
you know, with, you know, it's just, I commented on, I think it was one of Greg Cox's posts on Facebook that I think he just got, it was like a People's Choice Award kind of deal. I can't remember exactly what it was, but just as, you know, their people's favorite book recently. And, you know, David Mack kind of had a little tongue-in-cheek response about, you know, since he just had a book come out this year as well. And it's just like, and I commented, I was like, you guys just keep setting the bar higher and higher for each right. other. And it just makes our reading experience so much better.
Yeah. And well, in fact, just this morning I was reviewing some edits on Dayton Ward's next novel, To Defy Fate, the Picard tie-in. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very much looking forward to when that eventually makes it out in the public. It's still a few more months away. I can't remember what the pub date is, but
yeah, I think that's coming out at the end of April, I believe. April.
Yeah, that sounds right. And so I'm looking forward to when that comes out. It's very, you know, timey-wimey.
It's, sounds like Dayton.
Yeah. And so it, you know, there's a lot of stuff that ties back to so many of the novels that Dayton has done that, you know, have a lot of fun with time travel and all that stuff. So I'm, I'm excited to when that book gets out.
Yeah. Hopefully there's no wormhole cannons and, you know, destroying universes this time. I think we all have flashbacks.
Yeah. With, you know, all these books, we actually saw the sneaky little announcement on the Simon & Schuster site for Una's book coming out, I think, in August, called
The Peacemakers.
Peacemakers, yeah. Deep Space Nine book, which Jonathan and I are super excited about.
Oh, yeah.
What does the timeline look like for these? You know, because you got to work with the licensors, the franchise stakeholders, you know, along the way, like you said, with the pitch and the outline and everything. And then getting the author, obviously, to write the book and going through various drafts and edits and everything. But, like, what is... You know, and I just saw on Facebook too, Dayton mentioning that he just like turned in his final round of edits that it's just like, wow. And the book is coming out. It's got to go to the printers, you know, like what does the timeline look like on these things?
Our
like
editor,
how far in advance are we planning?
Our in-house editor, Sarah Schillick, had asked for Dayton to get these first layout corrections to her by the 5th. And so we were racing, you know, over the weekend, getting stuff done. Well, it kind of varies from book to book, and I actually don't. It's a weird thing to admit, but I don't have the. I never really have the schedules memorized, and they can they can get shifted around for various reasons. And since I'm freelance, you know, sometimes that shifting around, you know, that's going on in-house above my pay grade. And so, you know, then sometimes they just find out, oh, well, this has been shifted here, this has been shifted here. And so I just, you know, I just have to roll with the punches when changes happen. Mm-hmm. It's just like, okay, well, work on this as fast as I can. We'll try, you know, or, you know, if a book... You know, sometimes if one book might be coming in later than we had hoped, then maybe we try to bump another book earlier if, you know, depending on where the author is with it. And that's just something that since I've been in publishing for quite a while, since I had that other in-house job for 10 years, that just gave me a lot of experience in publishing is just a crazy business. You know, it's very deadline oriented, but then there's also all kinds of stuff. There's so many moving pieces that can affect that deadline, that schedule. And so you're so often having to adjust things and just, like I said, roll with the punches, and you just keep things moving, and you want to put out the best book you can and within the timeline that you have. And so it's can be a roller coaster ride, especially the last, well, many years now. Things are changing so much in publishing. I mean, over the last, 10 to 20 years, specifically with Amazon and ebooks and all this stuff just really upended the publishing industry. And then the last several years, particularly when, everyone's just in, buyout mode, or like with movie studios now, it's just like everyone's trying to buy everyone else. Yep. And it just makes things even more crazy because suddenly you might have a new corporate owner or whatever. It's a crazy business.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes to, we were talking earlier about how there's been a change in the, when it went to gallery books, there's been a bit of a decrease in the number of books published. Is that something where, is it Simon & Schuster who sets the number of books per year, or is it Paramount, or is it both of them? Like, can you give us any insight on that?
Well, I don't think I'm going too far out on a limb to just say it's a mutual discussion between the license holder and the licensee. And, and it's driven by sales and, all sorts of stuff. But again, that's something that is above my pay grade. So I don't have any input onto, even in this newer position, I don't have any input into how many books get published a year. I know that, as a fan, I would like more books, but, as an employee, I just do what I can.
You do. Yeah.
Gotcha.
We had a few years ago too, a couple books, one by Cassandra Rose Clark and the other by,
Alex White.
Alex White. TNG and a DS9 book, kind of legacy, books almost, weren't tied to new series. And that seemed like that was kind of a way to get new authors involved and get some more voices in the mix. And I don't want to complain because I love the current slate of authors we've got, but I just kind of curious, do we have anything like that? Is there anything you could talk about? But do we have anything like that in the plan where we're going to bring in new fresh blood, into the literary author canon?
That goes beyond the limits of my current remit. all the forthcoming books that are currently scheduled are from, the usual gang. And
which we love.
Yeah.
Yes, we do love them.
Every time. It almost doesn't matter whose name is on the book. It's like, I can't wait for the next so-and-so book. Oh, we got one coming up from this one instead. That's great, too. So there's it's really hard to have a swing and a miss with these authors recently, I think.
Yeah. They know what they're doing. It makes the job of both developmental and copy editor are really quite easy. With the gang that we work with, because they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
You told us we can't, go beyond the pipeline beyond 2026, but we've talked about Dayton's book, 2 to 5 Fate, and then we've talked about the Peacemakers by Una that's coming out. Are there any others that you can share yet, or is that still under wraps?
I can tell you that there's one more book that I'm working on or with the author, but I do not believe that any details have been announced publicly yet. So I don't, okay. I'm not even going to say who it's by or what series it's tied to, because I don't want to get in trouble.
Fair enough. Well, we're excited and we'll be here for it anyways. And we'll keep watching for the announcements. One of the things we talked to David Mack when Ring of Fire came out, and we've had multiple authors playing in the Strange New World series. Obviously, Dayton has the Picard novel coming out, which that series has ended. But with Strange New World still going on, we talked to David a little bit about this too, but you know, kind of from your perspective, how does that process work? Or it's obviously more constrained than writing, say, like Greg Cox's TOS novels, yeah, or something like that, where the universe is a little bit more wide open. But when you're working with Secret Hideout specifically on these shows that are still in production, do you like the challenge of trying to work within those constraints of the series, or does that make it a little bit more difficult? But, you know, we're going to rise to the challenge because we want the book to come out.
Well, you know, there are pros and cons, but it's a little bit easier with Strange New Worlds since they're not as heavily serialized as the other shows were. When the other shows were still on the air, you know, like Discovery, it was really hard to find a way to drop a novel in there. And that's why they were, you know, a couple of them at least were prequels.
Prequels.
Because that was the only way that you could really do a thing. And so it is a challenge, but it can very much be an enjoyable challenge, just like the challenge of fitting into the established canon. You know, and lots of times there are people that say, oh, that must be so annoying to have to work within all this established continuity. But the way I look at it, it's no different than, you know, if you write a novel set during World War II, well, then you have a whole bunch of established history that you have to, you know, if you want a realistic novel, if it's a non-genre World War II novel, well, then the soldiers have to have the right weapons, you know, people have to, you know, and so taking care of Star Trek continuity, it's really not that different than writing real world stuff. You are trying to be realistic within an established history, whether that history is real history or Star Trek fictional history. And so it can be a fun challenge to find where's, you know, a week where we can plop a story in between this episode and that episode. You know, a lot of the Strange New World stories over the years, you know, came out of those kinds of interesting challenges where there was a little loose end or a little, you know, time gap, a little retcon, a little, you know, what's something that we can explain. And so I think that we've done some really cool stuff with the novels and finding ways to make them fit in.
Yeah, I think that was, I mean, especially with Ring of Fire, it fit like just right where it was supposed to in it, you know. And even I know that David talked about some of the things that kind of got added in just to make sure that if you read that book between the two episodes, you know, that it was set between, that it would fit. And it's so fun, you know, as the reader too, with these ongoing like shows, to be able to see that. Cause I think a lot of us are so neurotic and it'd be like, oh, we want to watch this or read this chronologically or, you know, whatever. And we don't know exactly, and having the historian's notes, even in the books, you know, too, just to know exactly where they fit. So that's a lot of fun. If you were to pick, this is a little bit of a bigger, broader question, but do you have a Star Trek book, since you've read so many of them, that you think every fan should read? Or, you know, alternately, like, what would be a good starting point, I think, you know, from your experience, like, for somebody who wants to start reading Star Trek books?
This, I actually wrote an article, I can't remember what website it was for, one of the, you know, big fan, I'm embarrassed that I can't remember, but, or was it for the magazine? No, I think it was for a website. I was asked to write an article that gave advice on how a new person coming to the franchise, because the idea was that with the new shows in production, that there would be this new wave of fans coming in. And when they would start discovering that, oh, there's also books, how would you help them get in? And it was a challenge because, you know, there's like 900 books. I mean,
yep.
the the listeners can't see, but you guys can see behind me just a fraction of my Star Trek wall, because I own all the novels of, starting with the Bantam books, you know, from the 60s through all of Simon and Schuster. You know, I own all the novels.
Oh, my.
I've read them all.
That's incredible.
And so I found various ways to help guide people in. So, for instance, I might say, do you have a favorite series? And then and then you could sort of guide them toward that series. Or do you have a favorite character? Then you could guide them toward the books that feature that character. You know, if someone's favorite character is Spock, over the years, there's been a lot of Spock-centric novels. You can actually see one of the Spock-centric series right there behind me.
Is that the Vulcan Soul trilogy?
Yep.
I think, yep.
So yeah, I don't know if I'm trying to answer your question or trying to dodge the question, because there's so much to choose from. But I think one thing that would be interesting for new readers would be to go back to some of the books from back in the 80s, some of the Vonda McIntyre books that are really amazing science fiction that have to be Star Trek and are also, very different from the kind of stuff that we're producing now. And then I also think that it's kind of fun for people to read books that, because one of the requirements of writing Star Trek fiction is that you don't conflict with the established continuity. They're a little bit looser on that in some years. So you try to do that. When the book comes out, it's not supposed to contradict anything. That's even more challenging now when there's multiple shows going. Of course, after the book is published, the author has no control over what might happen in all the other stuff that comes afterward. And suddenly you have books that are astonishingly outside of, just way outside of stuff. Something like, now I'm blanking on the name. There was that one Klingon themed novel.
How much for just the planet?
No.
That was a weird one.
That was, sort of a comedy one. Yeah. There's a very Klingon heavy book that was written, back in the day, before Next Generation, when they started really fleshing out the Klingon culture.
Yeah.
And so that book, does not fit into the current picture of Klingons, but there's some really interesting stuff in it, so you kind of think of these things as alternate timeline or something, so you can still think of them as making sense from a certain point of view, but they don't fit into what we think of now. Well, and then there's, there was the series of Romulan themed books. That was Diane Duane, if I'm remembering correctly.
Right. Yeah.
And, those got sort of further and further away from the Romulans as they were being developed through Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. So I think some of those would be interesting for new readers. But then, of course, they would also really enjoy, if they are a fan of Strange New Worlds or the other recent shows, to read those books that are really, tightly fit into the continuity of the shows and theoretically might never go significantly out of continuity because of just the way that we're publishing books now. Things stay a little bit tighter to the shows. The shows that are more serialized, like Discovery, when you could get a book to sort of fit into that continuity, it's wedged in there pretty good. It's probably going to stay there.
Yeah. I think reading those classic TOS books, like for somebody who's, I think even for somebody who's not necessarily a Star Trek fan, going back and reading, like you said, those Vonda McIntyre books, like I keep thinking about the Entropy Effect, like the first original pocketbooks novel. well, or the Bantam books. I mean, those got really weird too, but I mean, it was like that classic sci-fi, you know, just like really outlandish things happening. And then you just kind of plop it in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah.
It might not be the best introduction to Star Trek for some people, but like they would definitely give them some good hard sci-fi in some cases.
Yeah. The Bantam books, they weren't really making that much of a, you know, continuity thing going on with those books. And so, yeah, they're very different from the shows in many respects, and they're very different from each other. You know, it was, you know, later on in the Simon and Schuster run when they started being a lot of internovel continuity and stuff that would happen in one novel by one author, you know, a different novel by a different author would take into account what had happened. And that developed a very, you know, big continuity, which of course then got derailed when Picard came on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then those three guys still managed to figure out a way to button everything up and bring it together.
Yep. Made it all make sense. So we can all still keep pretending it's all one big, you know, real thing.
Yep.
It all really happened.
All part of the plan.
Yep. The future history.
How do you approach editing for like something like Star Trek compared to, so you talked about doing nonfiction before, that's, you know, two very different genres. Is there like as an editor, do you find that you have different processes for when you're reading through a manuscript? Is it different for the tie-in stuff, or do you still generally follow the same patterns?
Generally the same. And well, the interesting thing is, you know, when I mentioned that if you were writing a World War II novel, you would have all those details that you would have to get right. Well, actually, World War II was a lot of stuff that I was editing as a nonfiction editor.
Right.
And so I had to be worried about, you know, the historical facts. I'm not a historian by any means. And so you're relying on the expertise of the author, but still as the editor of the book, that's your concern. And so as you're reading, as I would be reading a World War II history, for example, if there was some little comment or aside that I sort of stumbled over where I was like, wait a minute, does that sound right? I'm not sure about that. Then I would go and, you know, do some research and make sure I understood what the author was saying and that the author had it right. And most of the time the author did have it right because they were the expert and it was just something that I hadn't previously known. But there were those rare occasions where it's like, oh, wait a minute, it seems like the author is just a little off track here. I'll get in touch with them, make sure that we, you know, both understand each other and that we're getting the history right. And so when I'm working on Star Trek, you know, then it's that similar thing where you're thinking about the story and the language and grammar and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But then you're also thinking about those details, the facts that you have to get right. And so it's, you know, in many ways, very similar. What's different, of course, is fiction does not have to be real life. And so there are things that you can get away with. And I'm not just talking about, what's a coherent way to say this? I mean, you're worried about character motivation, and that's something that's not coming up when in most history books that I worked on. You know, it's like these are real people, and the history book is often more about recounting the facts in an interesting way and not necessarily questioning, you know, why did Patton do that? What was his motivation? Now, there are other history books that do get more focused on a specific figure like Patton, and that does delve deeper into their characters and why they behaved the way they did or made the decisions they did. But that would be a big difference for me in moving from nonfiction into fiction, is that you find yourself asking, well, why would the character do that? Because what can happen especially with writers not as experienced as this batch of people I'm working with, you can fall into a trap where you have a character do something because that's what you need the character to do to make the plot move forward. I mean, the best example of this is horror movies, where people often do stupid things because that's the only way that you're going to continue having a story, because they have to go into the basement where the lights don't work. but otherwise, in fiction, you really want it to make sense. Why would the character do that? And if it's something that seems very stupid on the surface, you want to come up with a way to make it make sense so it's believable. That's like, that character would do that. And when you're talking about something like Star Trek, where you might be writing Kirk and Spock that people have been watching and reading for 60 years, people have a very specific perception of how those characters act and how they would react in a given situation. And so that can be a, you know, an interesting tightrope, because you feel that these things have been so well established that everyone would have the same perception of how the character would react. But we all witness these things through our own eyes, our own subjective opinions. You think these things are objective, but I love to tell the story that when my ebook novella, The More Things Change, came out, that featured Dr. Chapel and Spock shortly after the events of Star Trek, the motion picture, one of the first, if not the first, reviews I got on Amazon, the person loved it. 5 stars. Spock and Chapel are, you know, exactly like they were in the show and the movies. Loved it. And then literally the next review was, I hated it. Spock and Chapel didn't act at all like they did. And so even something where it's just like, oh, we have decades of these characters on film, don't we all perceive their behavior the same way? And it's like, well, no, no, we don't.
No.
The same thing is kind of in the new Kelvin movies, where Uhura and Spock have a thing, and, you know, some fans are like, what? That came out of nowhere. But then even the writers are like, I mean, we just picked up on stuff that we kind of perceived on screen between the chemistry between the two characters.
In the original series episode, when Spock is playing the Vulcan and Uhura's singing, she's being very flirty with him.
Yeah, I think it was Charlie X. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think that there is, you know, you can look at that and say, well, yeah.
What if? Yeah. What if?
Do you find yourself, like, when you're reading a book, having to have like a page open on your computer of like memory alpha or memory beta? Or do you rely on dealing with any continuity stuff like that on like Dayton or people over at Paramount?
I am always watching. When I'm working on a Star Trek novel or on, well, I work on a lot of Star Trek stuff because I work on the novels. Mm-hmm. I also edit for the Star Trek Adventures role-playing game. And now I'm proofreading the Star Trek comic books from IDW. And if I have a question about something where I'm like, wait a minute, does this fit into the continuity of the show, or, you know, previously established stuff in the game or the comic books, I will start on something like Memory Alpha or Memory Beta to help me sort of narrow down, because I might not remember what specific episode or something. It's like there's a character name or something. I'm like, wait a minute, right, who is that? You know, there's so much stuff to keep track of. but then once I know where the reference came from, then if it's from one of the TVs or movies, I will often then go to the relevant scene and watch it just to make sure that it's right. Because I love Memory Alpha and Memory Beta, but, you know, they're put together by the fans, by a wide variety of people, and some of them are more careful than others. And so there are things that I've discovered on both sites that are catastrophically wrong about the source, the original source. And, you know, so when you're working on something professionally, it's like, well, you've got to go back to the original sources. So I go to the episodes, I go to the books. Now that I've been working on the books for over 10 years, I have all those books, you know, as Word documents on my computer. So if some reference comes up, I can go to the manuscript, do a keyword search, find a scene. And so it's funny, most of my viewing of Star Trek these days, when there's not a current show running, I'm only watching a minute here and there just to look at some specific. Well, in the Star Trek Adventures books, they do a thing where the chapter opener has a quote, a dialogue quote. So I go back to the episode or the movie and check the quote. Because sometimes writers might rely on a transcript online. Sometimes they might be relying on the captions. But, you know, I want to listen to the actors saying what they're saying and closely compare. Because sometimes the captions are wrong. Sometimes the quotes online are the people who might have written the article, they're quoting from memory. Because we all like to think we are such hardcore Star Trek fans that we remember things word for word. Well, then you, if you actually go back to the episode, you realize that it's gotten a little garbled over the years. And yeah, you have to make that correction.
And you know, those same Star Trek fans are also going to nitpick when they see a quote and kind of do some of that research themselves to make sure that you guys got it right.
Yes, that's, you know, that is a big, I mean, we want to get it right as fans, but we are also well aware that those fans are going to be, you know, finding every little thing that slipped through the cracks, especially when it's a, you know, a canon issue, a continuity issue, which, you know, can be part of the fun as long as no one gets too mean-spirited about it.
yeah, for sure. Well, as we kind of start wrapping up a little bit here, I guess as you look ahead, you know, say to this next year and beyond, 2026, 2027 and beyond, as you're starting to kind of create your own schedule, I guess, what excites you the most about the future of Star Trek storytelling, in specifically in the novels?
Well, I'll be really excited if I'm able to start developing more books from scratch with the authors, whether they're the, you know, the usual gang, or if I'm able to bring in some new people. Right now, I don't have any idea what's going to happen beyond the schedule that I was handed. And so I don't have, you know, I'm not keeping anything secret from you because I literally have no information. I'm not pulling back stuff that I know. I just don't know what's going to happen. I certainly have ideas of things that I would like to do, but as a freelancer also, you know, a lot of that, as I've referenced multiple times before, there are a lot of things that are above my pay grade, and I just have to see what can happen when the opportunity arises. And so right now, I'm just excited to work on the next couple of books. You know, I'm excited to be wrapping up the work pretty much on Dayton's book. You know, there'll still be a couple other reviews of corrections and the proofreader to, you know, but it's very close to being put to bed. And so then next up, I'll be, you know, my next big thing will be receiving Una's manuscript. And then as I'm working through that, I'll start working more on the book that I'm not yet going to name. And I'm very much looking forward to that. It was so exciting for me and overwhelming when I got the job, because then there was just a bunch of stuff that got dumped in my lap. It's like, okay, here's a couple outlines, here's a couple manuscripts, we're behind, you know, let's get going. And so it was overwhelming because I already had I'm a full-time freelance editor. That's what I do. So I edit for a lot of indie authors. I edit for Bane Books, and I...
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. And so I had a full plate. I had a very full plate on my calendar when suddenly I got the Star Trek job and had a lot of catching up to do. But it was so exciting to see the kind of stuff that I was going to be able to work on, and seeing that I was going to have a new DS9 novel, because, you know, there haven't been a lot of DS9 novels for the last few years. Mm-hmm. And so knowing that I was going to have a DS9 novel from Una was something I very much looked forward to. And so that's what I'm excited about.
Well, I had your website pulled up, and you've got a lot of stuff outside of Star Trek, obviously, that you work on too. So just kind of want to let you, you know, have a platform here to plug that. If there's anything that you want, that you're working on, you know, of your original fiction or other tie-in works that you want to talk about. And then also just kind of, how can people find you and interact with you online?
Yeah. Well, my two biggest things right now as a writer, I recently self-published a collection of a dozen short stories called The Sad Rains of Mars, New and Collected Stories. So 9 of the stories are available in various anthologies over the years. And then there are 3 stories that are not available anywhere except in this collection. And I had a lot of fun putting the collection together. I think it shows, you know, every story in there could essentially be called science fiction. But some of it is more like science fiction horror. Some of it is science fiction mystery. Some of it's retro sci-fi, because I love writing stuff that's more like Victorian science fiction. I have a story that brings together characters from The Time Machine, The Invisible Man, and War of the Worlds. I have a story, the title story, The Sad Rains of Mars, is about a Martian female detective on Mars that has been colonized by England. So it's a Victorian England colony. So that's got a very retro, you know, Jules Verne, Edgar Rice Burroughs kind of vibe to it. And so I put that out this summer. The current work in progress is the next volume in the Tales of the Weird World War series that I'm writing with William Leisner, who will be familiar to Star Trek readers. Mm-hmm. And so he and I are working on this shared universe kind of thing. And we've put out 2 volumes so far. In each volume, we each write separately a novella that is set in this increasingly alternate timeline where there are these shape-shifting monsters that are taking on human form, and no one really knows what they're up to or why or where they've come from. And each collection or each volume jumps forward about a decade. So the first volume was set in the 40s, second volume set in the 50s, and now we're working on the third volume that's set in the 60s. And I'm really having a lot of fun with that, you know. And sometimes characters that the other person created, we might pick them up and use them in our story. Other stories are more, you know, standalone, as far as they're not connected to, you know, character-wise, but they're all set in this continuity. That was the first thing. When I got the idea, I put together this decade-by-decade idea of how this progressed with these shapeshifters coming increasingly into our world. And then I got in touch with Bill and said, hey, how'd you like to do this with me? And so that's something we've been working on. So those are the 2 biggest things that I want to plug as far as my original writing. But if people go to scott-pearson.com, my website, you'll see, you know, all the books that I've had stuff published in. You'll see the stuff that I am self-publishing, because I've got other stuff out too that I've self-published. And you'll also, it's kind of fun. You can see all the stuff that I've worked on or I'm working on as far as an editor. So you can see the covers of the books I've edited, the covers of the comic books I've proofread. I'm having a lot of fun at IDW. You know, they got me, I got the gig as the Star Trek proofreader because of my Star Trek resume. But then they very quickly started sending me graphic novels and, you know, non-Star Trek stuff. And so I'm editing a couple, proofreading a couple of the comic books in their new IDW Dark imprint, the horror themed comic books. So I'm proofreading the tie-ins to A Quiet Place and the Smile films. Of course, you know, both of those are Paramount properties. This, you know, grew out of their established relationship with CBS Paramount. So I got a lot of fun stuff going on, both as an editor and a writer.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really fun to talk to you and just learn more about what you do and just the process in general for these Star Trek books. And just appreciate your time and look forward to having you back again.
Sure.
Some other time.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
Well, that was a really fun interview. I'm so glad we got to talk to Scott because, he's been so prolific within the Star Trek universe, but I don't think we would have necessarily known. I mean, we've seen his name in the acknowledgments, and you know, some of the authors recently have talked about Scott. He's got some short stories like he mentioned and novellas and stuff, but man, that guy's been hard at work on Star Trek. And we have, you know, as much as we had Margaret to thank for great Star Trek, we've also had Scott to thank too.
Absolutely. And in other genres as well. That was really cool to learn too. But speaking of Star Trek, we are going to my favorite series for our next book. You chose the book, but I heartily agree with it.
Yes.
And that is going to be Voyager Pathways by Jerry Taylor. So it's a more beefy book than the classic books usually are. But when it's the, you know, the co-creator of the show, you let her write what she wants to write.
Yeah.
So I'm excited. I've read Mosaic, but I haven't read Pathways yet, so this should be fun.
And Mosaic, you know, if I remember correctly, wasn't necessarily anybody's favorite book, but I think this one could be fun. I think even though it's longer, it's like every character kind of gets their little tale to tell, so it might feel more like short stories or vignettes or something. I don't know.
Okay,
so that I'm could excited. Be fun. Get a little history on each of the characters. Yeah.
That'll be our next big one. And we have some other fun stuff planned. So just keep on the lookout for all that.
Yeah, 2026 is shaping up to be a decent year for us. Even if we only have a couple books to look forward to, we've got some classics that we're going to be reading. So, in the meantime, while people are digging their way through Pathways, where can people find you, Jonathan?
You can find my YouTube channel at Jonathan Cohn. You can find my Twitter at Jonathan Cohn and my Goodreads at Jonathan Cohn.
Very nice. And you can find my YouTube at Bookbuster Reviews. And I also started an Instagram that I'm trying to keep up on for at Bookbuster Reviews. But we'll see how long that goes. I'm not going to become like a bookstagrammer, but...
But you will become a booktuber.
But I am becoming a booktuber. Other than that, you can find me on Goodreads at Knitting Trekkie and also poking around in the Babel Conference and other Star Trek-like groups on Facebook. But we thank everybody for listening today. And until next time, live long
and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.